Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sean Blackman, here with Jackie Lukman. And as always, we are your guide for connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Oh, yes, we're here. We're back. Top of the hour, Tuesday, August 4th, 2020. And of course, in 20 minutes, you'll be able to give us a call here By Any Means Necessary to give us your thoughts, ideas, questions, or concerns about anything you've heard on the show today, anything at all relevant happening on this earth. We want to hear from you. But that's not the only way you can reach out to us here on the show. And if you would, please, Jackie, let the folks know how they can keep in touch.
That's right, Sean, because there are so many ways for our allies, accomplices, comrades, and all the people in these streets to reach out and touch us at By Any Means Necessary here in Washington, D.C. They can do that at 3:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time by calling us at 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. But they can also hit us up on social media on Facebook.com/BAM Necessary. On Twitter at BAM Necessary. Then our shows can be downloaded on iTunes, where we would very much appreciate a good rating. They can hear us on iHeartRadio. They can spot us on Spotify. They can hear us speak on Spreaker. That's Spreaker. They can listen to us live on SputnikNews.com and on their radio dial at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. And remember, friends, at 3:20 p.m. Eastern today, you can call us at 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. But wherever you are in this world and however you do it, we want to hear from you.
We most certainly do. We most certainly do. At the top of the hour here, hundreds of people were wounded in an explosion in Beirut, of course, the capital city of Lebanon, according to Hamad Hassan, Lebanon's minister of health. Yeah, it happened at the port of Beirut and caused significant damages to buildings and shattered windows and things like that. Lots of videos and pictures being shared on social media. From what I've seen, there are at least 10 deaths being reported from this. The cause of the blast at this point is not immediately clear. Some are saying that it was due to some explosives being housed in some warehouse. But of course, an investigation is still pending. And so the more information comes out about that, we'll be sure to keep you all up to date. Also, President Donald Trump basically refusing to say something nice about recently deceased civil rights activist John Lewis. He was in an interview on Axios on HBO. And when, you know, basically, you know, Jonathan Swan was interviewing Trump and he asked him what he thought about, you know, Lewis's history and his activism. And Trump said, "I don't know. I don't know John Lewis. He chose not to come to my inauguration." And then Swan asked Trump if he thought Lewis was, quote, impressive. Trump said, quote, "I can't say one way or the other," sort of repeated that he didn't choose to go with his inauguration. But he did point out, quote, "Nobody has done more for Black Americans than I have. He should have come. I think he made a big mistake." Now, I mean, I think this is pretty, this kind of pettiness, I think we've come to expect from Donald Trump. I mean, this is the same cat. He wouldn't even say anything about John McCain, you know, after he died. So, you know, Donald Trump never.
Presidential level petty.
Yeah, the president of pettiness. And really, in truth, I'm not sure what a compliment from Donald Trump is really worth anyway. But be that as it may, we are joined for the hour today by Dr. Gerald Horn, Morris Professor of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston and author of the new book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Dr. Horn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And, you know, Dr. Horn, I think it's a very appropriate time to talk about your new book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, which sort of, I think, further digs down and explicates sort of the true root of the United States as a nation, and particularly at a time when the country is still in an uproar in the midst of a revolt against racism on the one hand, while being in a real social, political, and economic crisis on the other. I mean, due to the coronavirus pandemic and the complete abandonment of the American people by its government, and no real sort of a solution or alternative being put forth for those people, at least in the American mainstream. And it seems that when we look at, you know, when we look at capitalism and white supremacy and all these sorts of systems and forms of systemic oppression that have been rolling on for a few centuries at this point, I mean, it actually seems to an extent, Dr. Horn, that what we're seeing today in the United States is really a part of the logical conclusion of a system that was birthed in a bloodshed, slavery, and genocide.
Well, I'm afraid to say that you have a good point that you're making. One of the points that I'm trying to make in this book is that what we're witnessing today in terms of this marauding white supremacy is reflected on May 25th, 2020, when George Floyd was lynched on camera in Minneapolis, that it is not a bug of the system, to use the soft word lingo. It's a feature of the system. The system is operating the way it was designed to operate. Now, some might be asking, well, Professor Horn, how did we move from slavery to where we are today? I would suggest that it has a lot to do with global conditions. That is to say that the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system, which could only be resolved with this collapse. You saw that London, the then preeminent power, because it felt it was going to lose one of its richest colonies, which is nearby Haiti, speaking of Jamaica, not to mention Antigua, Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, St. Kitts, etc., decided that the better part of wisdom, 3 years after 1804, to move away from the slave trade, and then decades before the United States abolished slavery, to move away from slavery itself. And then Haiti and London gang up on the United States, helping to force the U.S. Civil War. And then that leads to the system of U.S. apartheid, Jim Crow, the arising of a socialist camp assisting national liberation movements in Africa and the Caribbean with many resources that the United States lusts for. The United States feels that it will be disadvantaged in terms of competing for favor, hearts and minds in these newly emerging countries. And particularly since people of color, African Americans in particular, are treated so atrociously, that the United States decides that the better part of wisdom is to move agonizingly away from Jim Crow. And so now we're at a particular moment in 2020 where I'm afraid to say that the international situation is not as favorable to our protests as they once were. And then I'm also afraid to say that our movement is not necessarily advanced to take advantage of whatever international currents are blowing favorably towards us. For example, just a few weeks ago, we know that the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, the African Union tried to initiate a commission of inquiry into systemic racism in the United States of America. Many of our activists on this side of the Atlantic were wholly unaware of this initiative on our behalf because I think we lost a certain kind of global consciousness, and then our organizations are not necessarily up to speed either. So certainly we need to move to alter those two pressing problems, because I'm afraid to say that some of our forces are mobilizing very enthusiastically and mightily against us, and it would be a sin and a transgression if we were to ignore that.
Appreciate the global aspect that you bring forth in this book, explaining how the forces around the world came together to create this situation that led to the establishment of the colonies and slavery and eventually the United States. I think that's a really important aspect of this conversation that we miss a lot, especially when we talk about slavery and the abolition of slavery in England and Europe, and the tangential effects that slavery from Europe had, not just on the Caribbean nations, because it certainly did, but also on the United States. Now, there's a big, just a huge deflection of the issue of American slavery when we bring up Thomas Jefferson's admonition that slavery was basically England's fault. To a certain degree, he makes a point, but that's not at all the whole story. So you do fill in a lot of that whole story in your book, what is the direct connection between the othering of people, England's role in racialized slavery that comes from a long history of bigotry in England that was transplanted to the shores of the Americas that ended up metastasizing in the colonies?
Well, I point out in the first few pages of this book that England and the model of development that led to the construction of whiteness and white supremacy, in some ways, it was an adaptation. What I mean is that England had expelled this Jewish population in 1291, 200 years before Spain did in 1492, as Columbus was about to sail the ocean blue. And yet, we see that London, England, opens its arms to embrace Jewish refugees and Jewish settlers because it was under the gun. This was taking place in the context of a sharp religious conflict between Protestants and Catholics. Catholic Spain, which sponsored Columbus and thereby had the first mover's advantage in terms of implanting settler colonialism, and Protestant London. Protestant London being a scrappy underdog, perpetually on the verge in the 1500s of being attacked by Catholic Spain and being overthrown, decided that what it needed to do was move away from religion as the animating axis of society, as a qualification for settlement, which was the Spanish model, which was implanted in St. Augustine's Florida in 1565 and was attempted in Pensacola in 1559, and moved towards pan-Europeanism, which morphs into whiteness and then morphs into white supremacy. Now, what's striking is that many of the tropes that were employed early on by against the Jewish population of the 13th century are then transferred almost wholly to people of African descent and the indigenous population. I'm speaking of these tropes that suggest that Black people have a particular and special odor. These tropes that suggest that Black people have tails. In fact, as recently as World War II, Black soldiers, when they first encountered some of their Euro-American compatriots, they found that the Euro-American compatriots were trying to peek over their shoulders to see if they had a tail, believe it or not. And then, of course, trying to bar miscegenation and intermarriage, which was the law in the United States up until 1967 with the Loving versus Virginia case, which reaches the U.S. Supreme Court. So, what happens is that then this monster of white supremacy then causes not only a retreat to a certain degree of this religious conflict, but then it dulls class struggle notions as well. It dulls class antagonisms because many of those defined as white, even if they're not necessarily wealthy, they feel the need to throw in their lot with their wealthier compatriots who are defined as white, in order to get in on the banquet of seizing Native American land, and with a little bit of luck and a lot of pluck, finding and snaring enslaved Black people to work that land and contribute wealth that pours into their already bulging purses.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, on the question of settler colonialism, I was, because you mentioned some Caribbean nations earlier when you were sort of making your broader point about these broader systemic issues. And I was thinking about how, you know, we've been seeing unrest in the Caribbean, I think, in a number of ways here lately, and in some cases before the George Floyd protest. And I'm just wondering sort of how you're considering the connection between the history of settler colonialism and even neo-colonialism and the sort of ongoing orientation of the West, the imperial and colonial powers, towards that region of the world that still seems very much to think of the Caribbean as its backyard. I mean, not that long ago, we were seeing clashes in the streets in Trinidad and Tobago between police and protesters. Also, when Curaçao, a similar thing, with people calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Eugene Rogonoff. We've been talking on the show about what's been happening in Haiti with their council that recently resigned, which very well may strike a definitive blow against the presidency of Jovenel Moise, and so on and so forth. I mean, we see the elections in Guyana and the issue of oil that's caught up in that. So it's a very sort of a active and consequential part of the world that gets very little attention. But a lot of the contradictions, I think, that continue to exist there really have these same institutions at its root. And it's also interesting to sort of note some of the more progressive figures in the region, like Ralph Gonsalves and Mia Motley and Prime Minister Skerrit of Dominica and things like that. So I'm wondering how you sort of see this broader history in the Caribbean, Dr. Horn, connected to the sort of geopolitical situation of the region today.
Well, first of all, the historical point, even Alexander Hamilton, who I'm afraid to say has been turned into a kind of hero in this new musical Hamilton, which has taken Broadway by storm, at least pre-lockdown, and now is playing on various networks. What needs to be stressed is that Alexander Hamilton was one of the many men and women of European descent who was chased out of the Caribbean, Nevis in his case, to the North American mainland because there were so many revolts in the 18th century in particular taking place in the Caribbean that many of these European settlers made the great trek to the North American mainland, thereby bolstering and bulwarking the settlers here, which makes it more possible for them to implant slavery into this particular territory, which means that there has been ever an intimate connection between events in the Caribbean and events in the North American mainland and now the United States of America. Now, with regard to what's happening today, unfortunately, because of the pandemic, you've had a virtual collapse of one of the major props of the Caribbean economy. I'm speaking of tourism. That is to say that you have hotels, for example, that heavily depended upon tourism. You have the ships that sail into port and offload tourists and then spend money. That's basically been shut down to a certain degree because of the pandemic as well. And this has led to a contraction of many Caribbean economies and a significant kind of misery, particularly in countries with which we're familiar, such as Jamaica, Barbados in particular. You mentioned in your litany the situation in Guyana on the northern coast of South America, the only predominantly English-speaking country in South America, and therefore is part of CARICOM, the Caribbean community, and relates very closely to CARICOM. You've had Guyanese leaders historically, particularly the late Chetty Jagan, a founding father of modern Guyana, who was considered to be a Caribbean leader. And now you see with ExxonMobil helping to uncover a major source of petroleum in the waters off Guyana, this has caused not only ExxonMobil and Washington to become more heavily involved in the internal affairs of Guyana, but it's also intensified the squabbling between the two major parties. That's to say, one generally described as pro-South Asian, another generally described as pro-African, which led to an elongated electoral process, which just, in a sense, was resolved with the PPP, the so-called pro-South Asian party, emerging triumphant. But there's going to be a lot of pressure on this new government, not only from its internal foes who feel that this election was not conducted in a way they consider to be proper, even though the PNC, the so-called pro-African party, was basically in charge of the electoral operations, but also because of this increased and intensified effort to make sure that Guyana does not claim this petroleum wealth, perhaps overriding everything else, the attempt to turn Guyana into a kind of spearhead against neighboring Venezuela. For decades now, there has been an outstanding territorial issue between Guyana and Venezuela. And I'm afraid to say there's going to be pressure on Guyana to try to press Venezuela in that regard and try to see Guyana as a kind of frontline state against Venezuela, because John Bolton, in his recent memoir, The Room Where It Happened, he points out, at least according to Mr. Bolton, and you have to consider the source, that he points out that Mr. Trump may not have been as enthusiastic about foreign interventions in certain countries, but he was gung-ho and down with an intervention in Venezuela, which he felt should have been part of the United States anyway, according to John Bolton. And the fact that Venezuela has oil deposits, the fact that some of Mr. Trump's major financial supporters, particularly in Texas, are the notorious Texas oil men who have been a bulwark and a foundation of right-wing politics in the United States, stretching back decades, at least to the beginning of the 20th century, that does not necessarily bode well for a smooth path for this new PPP government in Georgetown, Guyana.
Definitely. We're going to move to our first break of the hour on that note here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C., but we will be back. So please stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sean Blackman, here with Jackie Lukman. And as always, we are your guides for connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Phone lines are now open, 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. Myself and Jackie Lukman continue to be joined by Dr. Gerald Horn. And you know, Dr. Horn, you mentioned in our last segment the popularity of the stage play Hamilton. And it's kind of interesting to have an honest to goodness historian on the show to talk about this, because I'm curious, you know, if you could get some more into your thoughts about that and the fact that it's really become a sensation, particularly among liberals and progressives in the U.S., despite the reality of Alexander Hamilton in this country. Because for me, it's sort of beyond the pop culture product, but really more so a question of history as propaganda and how the framing of something can sort of help to whitewash the criminal aspect to a lot of the building blocks that went into the establishment of this country.
Well, it's not only that point, which you correctly and cogently make, that is to say, this play Hamilton, even Lin-Manuel Miranda, the playwright, the author of this concoction, acknowledges that the critique that the play does not deal adequately with the question of slavery, which was at the root of the formation of the United States of America, and helps to explain in no small measure why the descendants of enslaved Africans have been treated so horribly and atrociously since 1776. He acknowledges that that is a weakness of the play. And this is actually part of a larger story that I'm going to be speaking on shortly at a virtual conference. That is to say, I think we're at a fraught moment. Hopefully, it's a promising moment where you're having an ongoing battle for the creation of what I call a new left. And this battle oftentimes takes the shape of a battle between those who consider themselves to be liberal and those to their left. For example, if you look at the most stinging critique of Hamilton, it's been done by Ishmael Reed. He wrote an entire play lampooning and spearing Hamilton. If you look at this latest controversy about so-called cancel culture, this letter that appeared in Harper's, we mentioned, I think, on the last time I was on your program about one of the co-authors. The other co-author was a self-described liberal by the name of Mark Lilla, who wrote an entire book castigating Black Lives Matter because, believe it or not, he says that they were responsible for the election of Trump in 2016. Now, I won't try to explain this complex argument, if I can use that term, that leads to that harebrained conclusion. But in any case, what he's objecting to when he drafted that letter was this movement from below, where you see in Washington, D.C., for example, you have certain Ivy League historians who are defending the Lincoln statue with a Black person kneeling, and those to the left of these Ivy League historians who are criticizing this Lincoln statue. I could go on with this litany, but I think what's happening is that there is something new that's struggling to be born. That is to say, this new left, and it's facing resistance, which we should not see as a surprise, because you may recall that if you look at the anti-Jim Crow movement of the 1960s, liberals were oftentimes excoriated by anti-Jim Crow activists, which I think led to certain liberals to try to rebrand themselves as progressive. And this was an understandable denunciation because, for example, the so-called liberal Daniel Patrick Moynihan went on to become a U.S. senator from New York. He was the figure that began to attack Black women, saying the problem with the Black community was Black women wielded too much influence, believe it or not, because of this alleged and purported Black matriarchy. That came from liberals. And so we are in this titanic struggle right now. It's unclear how it's going to eventuate, but I think we can probably see it as a hopeful and promising sign.
Yeah, we actually have a caller on the line. Lamont, tell us what's on your mind.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Thank you so much for taking my call. You guys have a solid, solid show today, man. Everything has been great. Been feeling everything. I just wanted to say that when I think at the current state of affairs today, like the U.S. and its neoliberal policies, I kind of think back to myself how, if you guys remember, it was called Operation Condor. But just to kind of explain, it was just this concerted effort by the U.S. to kind of put in place these right-wing governments in South America and to, by any means necessary, right, to stomp out all of the, you know, leftist opponents or activists or things like that. And it left a body count of about 60,000 people dead, you know, all for what? For an ideology, because we probably just had this intense hatred towards the Soviet Union. Soviet Union, sorry, communism, whatever it may be, but it was just all for this ideology. So, I mean, I think today, too, this is just a kind of continuity of that, too, you know, because we have a similar situation, you know, a lot of these right-wing governments in South America currently now that oppose individuals like Evo Morales, who, you know, has a large, popularity within the masses of his own country that was democratically elected. I mean, we see these things play over and over, you know, and just the propaganda, the right-wing propaganda and machine in this country is just really seriously working itself in overload. But, you know, if there's anything to kind of have a glimmer of hope for, I think, is that now, during this pandemic and just seeing the role of our essential workers and just people that just really had to hold it down to kind of keep society moving, I think it's safe to say that the majority of the American population, of the working class, and the majority of young Americans today now know that socialism is not a bad word. I mean, could we just be honest about that, you know? So I just could only hope that we need a cohesive movement in this country. We have to bring the focus back onto the people, I think, you know, just this, you know, I don't know. But that's all the time I'm going to take up for you guys. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you, Lamont. I appreciate you listening as always. And I think that's a good question. Dr. Horn, any response to our caller here?
Well, just briefly, I think he makes a fair point with regard to Operation Condor and how it may be continuing. After all, a part of the fruit of Operation Condor, the rotten fruit at that, was the coup in Brazil in the 1960s, which brought the military to power and led to repression of left-wing forces. And today, you see left-wing forces like former President Lula still behind bars as a result of this sort of legalized coup, if I can use that term, against his successor, Dilma Rousseff. And as well, you see a mostly military-dominated cabinet in Brasilia, under the Trump of the tropics, the President Jair Bolsonaro. Likewise, you just made reference to Bolivia and the ousting of Evo Morales and the continual postponing of elections. And certainly, I think that imperialism, U.S. imperialism, has not stopped with regard to its maniacal and diabolical urge to both control resources in South America and also to ensure that there's a cheap labor supply as well. That cheap labor supply, of course, should be not unfamiliar to people in North America.
Yeah, we have another caller on the line. Baltimore Charles, tell us what's on your mind.
Yes, good afternoon, my friends. How are you today?
Good.
All good.
Oh, great, great. You know, it's really a pleasure to hear such a deep, deep historical thinker as Dr. Horn on there. And I wanted to try to horn on... Dr. Horn, if I could, just a pun there, but to one critical issue and see what your take is on this. And I'm harking back to you had mentioned Loving versus Virginia and the miscegenation laws. And I'm thinking back to Frances Cresswell's and her keys to the color confrontation. And I'm thinking along the many, many years up to the killing of George Floyd, who was who had a significant other who was a white woman and produced a child. To what extent do you think that that theory of Wells's, that what is driven with the racism and the police killings and so forth of black men particularly, is driven by that theory of the genetic annihilation of the race, that you cannot, because the majority of the world is made up of people of color, and white people only make up like maybe one-tenth of that, if that much, that they are driven either subconsciously or otherwise by this need for survival that goes beyond just a self-hate theory, but also to protect themselves against genetic annihilation. And can this problem be ever solved? And is that issue, Frances Cresswell's says, it is called the fire. And that is when you, you know that you're closer to fire and you won't touch it, because you know it will burn you, and that has to do with the white black men mixing with these white women out here and causing that situation. I hope I have not confused the issue too much, but I'm interested in your take on that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Baltimore Charles. Always good to hear from you. I think you may have asked that before. I'm not. I can't speak to the ethnic background of George Floyd's partner, and I don't think that. Was necessarily a factor in the events that led up to his death at the hands of former officer Derek Chauvin. But Dr. Horn, I'll give you an opportunity to weigh in here.
Well, with respect to the caller, I confess that I'm sympathetic to the Gerald Horn theory of white supremacy, which is grounded in historical analysis going back in the book that we were talking about, going back to 1095. I may do another book which goes back even further to the conflict between the Nubians and the heart of Africa and the Roman Empire about 800 years, or actually I'd say hundreds of years before 1095. And so I tend to lean towards my own historical materialist analysis, which privileges the question of economics, the desire to extract wealth from free labor, enslaved African labor, which then leads to a superstructure of trying to rationalize this by suggesting that these people are inferior. So in sum and in short, that's the theory that propels me and that persuades me. And coincidentally enough, it's reflected in this book that we're now discussing, The Dawning of the Apocalypse.
Jackie Lukman, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I feel like there are some times when, you know, the history that we have right in front of us and that we do have to uncover and interrogate is kind of pushed aside sometimes for more kind of, exciting or salacious aspects of theory. But the history isn't theory. We know how we got here, and I'm deeply appreciative of Dr. Horn's new book and an aspect of this history of the implanting, the entrenching of white supremacy and settler colonialism and the precursor to capitalism that occurred here in this part of the Americas. Because one aspect of this history that is so rarely examined is kind of the switching out of Catholicism versus Protestantism with race as a kind of tool of social hierarchy, the establishment of a social hierarchy. And I don't think that's very well understood, but I feel like you did a really amazing, at least for me. I was very, very pleased and very, I think, a little bit shocked, because it was a history I didn't know and didn't understand about the role of the way religion was not like infected by white supremacy, as so many historians and theologians are supposing now. But it was really, as you state in your book, Dr. Horn, that instead of religion being the way that classes were assigned in old Europe, here, it wasn't religion anymore. It became race. So I'm wondering if you can comment on that a little bit to expose a little bit of that history that maybe people don't understand.
Well, I think people have forgotten the murderous conflict that existed in the 1500s between Protestants and Catholics. I zero in on 1572 in predominantly Catholic France, where the rulers invited the Protestant minority to meetings all over the country and then fell upon them and massacred them all. Perhaps tens of thousands of Rwanda-type slaughter. And what's striking is that there was a fear in London, Protestant London, that this was going to befall Protestant London. That is to say, the Spanish powers would invade, which they tried to do, you may recall, in 1588. And this question of religious conflict, as I tried to suggest a few moments ago and suggested at length in the book, then becomes the root of racism. Because what happens is that if you try to track down the roots of white supremacy and the roots of racism, as I suggested a moment ago, you could go back to the Crusades, for example, in 1095, when the Western European Christendom tries to reclaim what they call the Holy Land, which leads to this murderous conflict between Christians and Muslims. But then by 1453, the Muslims are on the march. They overthrow Christians in what is now Istanbul, Turkey, are seemingly marching towards Western Europe. And keep in mind that in any case, the Muslims were ruling Spain for hundreds of years up until 1492. But with the encounter with the Americas and the need for free labor, or the perceived need for free labor on the part of the Western Europeans, London in the first place, the decision is made that having Protestantism as a qualification for settlement will not do. You can have a stronger base for settler colonialism and to implant slavery if you move from religion, being Protestant, to being European, which then morphs into whiteness and then white supremacy, and then justifying and rationalizing by suggesting and arguing that those that you are enslaving, either A, in the first instance, they need to be enslaved because they're not Christians, they're heathens, and then moving from there to the racialized formation that they need to be enslaved, or they should be enslaved, because they're less than human. As the U.S. Constitution suggests, they're three-fifths of a human. And therefore, you would not necessarily put your cattle on the same level as yourself. So why should you put an enslaved African on the same level as yourself? That's the kind of historical materialist approach that I prefer and that is reflected in the pages of my book.
Definitely. And we appreciate that orientation so much. And we're going to move to another quick break on that note here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. But we will be back. So please stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back. So By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sean Blackman, here with Jackie Lukma. And as always, we are your guide for connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. My dear friends, phone lines are still open, 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. I am here. Jackie Lukma is here. Dr. Gerald Horn is here. And you know, Dr. Horn, one thing that I think about a lot from the standpoint of history, and because we've been discussing your new book about the roots of slavery, white supremacy, settler colonialism, and capitalism, the dawning of the apocalypse. And I think specifically about how those institutions not only go into the building blocks of a country itself, but how that impacts the way that a nation conceives of itself and how a people see themselves and how they conceive of themselves in their position in the world. Because, you know, people talk a lot, and rightfully so, about American exceptionalism, this concept of American exceptionalism, right? But really, what we call American exceptionalism is just imperial arrogance, in my opinion. This thought that this country somehow is the paragon of all things democratic and free and all those sorts of high-minded concepts, to the point where no other system even need be entertained, nor do we feel the need to be terribly informed about what happens on the rest of planet Earth, sort of implicitly thinking that the U.S. is, in fact, the center of the known universe around which everything else revolves. And, you know, that doesn't happen by accident. And I'm just wondering how you sort of see this centuries-long history with that's, you know, marked and really defined by these crimes against humanity that continue to this day, and how you see it connected to, you know, the national attitude of the United States, if we could call it that.
Well, I'm afraid to say we've had a recent example of this arrogance and this so-called exceptionalism that you just made reference to. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas was already being touted as a 2024 presidential nominee on the GOP ticket, has recently introduced legislation that would deprive school districts of federal funding for education if they use the 1619 project of Nicole Hannah-Jones, which, as you recall, among other things, the charge that a motive force for the founding of the United States was to perpetuate enslavement of Africans. And if you read the legislation carefully, what he suggests is that any critical examination of slavery in K through 12, kindergarten through 12th grade education is now would be forbidden if this legislation is passed. And he went on to say that he considered slavery of enslavement of Africans to be a, quote, necessary evil, unquote, with emphasizing necessary. So in other words, in order to build this so-called great country, our ancestors had to be enslaved. And once you begin to rationalize mass enslavement and rationalize genocide against the indigenous population, not only can you rationalize just about anything, but then you begin to wonder what else can be rationalized in order to keep the United States moving along in the 21st century. And there are also some cautionary notes that I would hope listeners would pay attention to in this book, because as I tell the story, this so-called question of religious liberty embedded in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, traditionally the way it's talked about is that it's a product of religious and a product of enlightenment. You have these great thinkers who decide, oh, you know what? We need to move away from religious sectarianism because that's not a good idea. In other words, it's basically saying that consciousness shapes being rather than the other way around. But as I tell the story, moving away from religious sectarianism and embracing those London had been warring against, such as Irish Catholics, such as the Jewish population, etc., is not necessarily a product of enlightenment. It's a product of needing every warm body you could round up to confront rebellious Africans and rebellious indigenous populations. And so therefore, when the U.S. Supreme Court, as it recently did in its most recent decisions, decide that it's going to try to erase the distinction between religion and the state and move towards what some would hope would be a certain kind of Christian fundamentalism, a kind of right-wing theocracy, that is a direct product of what I'm suggesting, that these ideas of religious liberty are not necessarily embedded in progressivism, as some would like us to think. They were embedded in pragmatism, a pragmatic settler colonialism at that. And so, therefore, the roots are embedded in shallow ground and can be shaken as they are being shaken today.
Yeah, we have a caller on the line who's been waiting patiently. Terry, tell us what's on your mind.
Yes, good afternoon. I want to thank all three of you for the effort that you're making today. And I would just like to add to the conversation by saying that everything is illegitimate. I think that the political system is illegitimate. The legal system is illegitimate. The religious system is illegitimate also, because when the first people who sailed wherever they were coming from came here, there were no law books sitting on this soil. So it's not like it's like they can say thousands of years of, you know, there were no physical law books sitting on this soil. This religion that we're being forced into, it's illegitimate, because the only religion that exists is the religion of white supremacy. And that means that it's the mistreatment of people based on color in their skin. It doesn't matter whatever name we want to call it. It doesn't matter how far it goes back. And it really doesn't even matter whatever the supposed conflict is. It's only a matter of, does this white group dominate all of the people of color, or does that white group? But in the end of the day, it is nothing but white supremacy, racism, and it's parading around like it has some legitimacy. This is a whole planet that the Creator gave for all of us to enjoy. And there are some people who were extremely lazy. And this is how it has to be formulated in the mind. Extremely lazy, that they had to go all the way around the world to work people. They couldn't do it by themselves. This did not get done by itself, and it didn't get done physically by them. So we have to reform our minds and stop allowing the brainwash to continue. And I respect the academic effort of you, Dr. Horn, because it's just beyond, you know, all that you have done to tease all of this out. But I think to add on top of it is that we're going to have to really look at the brainwash, and we have to take advantage of the present moment, because the present moment is where the power is. And even the second that we look back at some other things, we miss this present moment where the only power that there is. And that's what I wanted to add to the conversation today.
Well, thanks so much, Terry. Really appreciate you calling. Hope to hear from you again soon. Dr. Horn, your response.
Well, the only point I would add is that U.S. imperialism is facing stiff challenges today. I was subjected to watching recently the many hours of a symposium at the Trump Hotel in Washington, spearheaded by the Freedom Caucus of the House of Representatives. These are the most extremist right-wing Republicans in the House, co-sponsored by Liberty University of Reverend Falwell in Lynchburg, Virginia. And what was striking was the hysteria about China. Not only the hysteria about China, but trying to suggest that the protests in the wake of the George Floyd killing from the Atlantic to the Pacific were basically engineered by the Chinese Communist Party. Now, some of us have seen this movie before. We recall how the anti-Jim Crow movement in the 1950s and 1960s, supposedly that was all a product of Moscow, which then allowed for surveillance of these alleged foreign agents. So this same scenario and the same plot is in motion. And the question, and I'm not sure if I can answer this question sadly enough, is will we be sufficiently educated and sophisticated to repel this kind of counterattack, or as happened to some of our colleagues, so-called, in the 1950s and 1960s, will they basically go for the okey-doke?
Jackie Lukman, yeah. You're a good church-going lady. I'm interested in your thoughts on this.
I'm sure my dad is real appreciative every time you say that, but he's still wondering who is talking about. But I mean, I always have to remind myself that we are deeply, deeply indoctrinated in this country. And that's right down to whatever we believe in our spiritual faith. And I really appreciated, you know, Dr. Horn's attention to this aspect of this system of white supremacy and settler colonialism and capitalism that's morphed into what it is today, this imperialistic, evil white supremacist a juggernaut that is infecting the world, because at the root of this faith that is not steeped in white supremacy, it is a faith that does come partially out of Africa and darker, so-called darker regions of the world that have been demonized, interestingly enough, by the same people who took the faith and turned it into something else. The truth is that much of that faith is based on the interpretation of those beliefs for the benefit of the capitalist state, of the settler colony, of the imperialist machinery. When you get down to the bedrock of what the faith is, and the faith is Jesus Christ and what he said and what he taught, that's a whole different story. So you look at it from a different perspective. But Dr. Horner, I can't help but wonder how you feel about how we are meeting this moment, because I feel like we're kind of at a moment of apocalypse. And an apocalypse just means an unveiling or revealing of something that you couldn't have seen were it not for the unveiling. It just means change. And I'm wondering if you feel like we're meeting this moment with the, at least the proper attitude of the gravity with which the moment is dictating. Because I do agree that I don't think we have the historical analysis, most of us, to really understand where we are. But I'm wondering if you feel like there is the proper sense of urgency to at least for people to recognize that we are fighting on all fronts here. We are fighting a rabid right wing in this country politically, also spiritually and organized religion. But we're also fighting an intransigent so-called left wing, where these Ivy League historians that you mentioned earlier are lashing out at progressives who are accusing them of cancel culture because these folks who are resisting the system are calling the those who have upheld the system out on their continual perpetuation of these narratives and mythologies that have harmed people. So I'm wondering how you're feeling about the attitude that we have in this moment, and if we need to shift that.
Well, I would have to give a mixed response. On the one hand, like so many of us, I'm heartened by the protests. I'm heartened by the youthful protesters in particular and what that augurs for the future. On the other hand, as I scan the battlefield, I have to acknowledge that as of today, I cannot say with certainty that the Oval Office will be defeated on November 3rd, 2020. And that's something that should be of concern to all fair-minded people. And likewise, as I scan the battlefield, I not only see these formidable right-wing forces as embodied in the aforementioned Freedom Caucus and their millions of supporters, including the 63 million who voted for Donald J. Trump, but also these liberal forces who are basically fighting a war position against those to their left. They don't want to give up their privileged positions. They are willing to see us squashed. And with regard to this so-called cancel culture, pay careful and close attention to an op-ed that appeared in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago by the former senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch, who suggested that cancel culture, so-called, should lead to a purging of colleges and universities of people like myself, because supposedly we're tyrannical and we're not allowing freedom of speech and all the rest. That's a very ominous and dangerous signal. And we all know that it's happened before.
Yeah, and that's really the danger of that sort of thing, as I think you're highlighting, Dr. Horn, is that that sort of narrative about how these types are framing so-called cancel culture, I mean, it's really just, it's a way to sort of squash the sort of, you know, truly progressive and truly left-leaning elements in different elements of society, whether we're talking about academia or media or politics or whatever and what have you. And so I agree that it's definitely something that we have to keep an eye on. I mean, it's so funny because it makes me think about these people who, you know, will criticize, you know, someone like myself or Jackie for having a platform on Russian media saying that we're just dupes of Vladimir Putin and things like this, presenting it as though, well, we're the problem. Well, no, I think the problem is that if you look at the major platforms, you don't hear these types of voices or these types of perspectives. I mean, you know, and Dr. Horner is a very humble and gracious person, but I mean, he, in my opinion, is a far more legitimate source than just so many people that we see on a lot of these different news shows. I mean, a lot of these folks are just kind of self-made pundits with really not that much of substance to bring to the table. So So don't ask me, you know, why we have this platform here. I mean, talk to Rupert Murdoch, talk to Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post. And so it's just clear that there's an effort on several levels to keep these sorts of narratives and to keep these voices out of the loop, because if these perspectives were allowed to penetrate the mainstream, well, that could not only be a threat to the platform themselves, but of the capitalist system and the liberal democracy upon which they are built. But we're going to leave it there for today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I want to thank Dr. Gerald Horn for joining us today. Definitely pick up his new book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. But we'll be back tomorrow with an all-new episode. So as always, we'll see you next time. Peace.
By any means necessary.